WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Well, in the studio with me now is composer, choreographer, and director-designer of theater pieces, Meredith Monk. She's in Philadelphia for a performance tomorrow evening at the University Museum. The concert is being sponsored by the Institute of Contemporary Art. She's going to be performing Songs from the Hill, music for unaccompanied solo voice, and Tablet, music for four voices, organ, and recorder. Three other performers will be accompanying her. The concert is tomorrow evening at 8 o'clock at the University Museum. Before we begin talking, let me tell you a little bit about her. In 1971, her piece Vessel, an opera epic, received the Obie Award for Outstanding Achievement in the Off-Off-Broadway Theater. Her opera Quarry played at La Mama in New York and the Brooklyn Academy of Music. It received excellent reviews from the critics in New York. I saw Quarry at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, and I'll just add my praises to it. Meredith has collaborated with Merce Cunningham and Ping Chong. She's toured Europe. Her work is very exciting, and I think if you've never heard her music before, you'll find it very unusual. We're going to hear a sample of her album now called Our Lady of Late, Music for Voice and Glass. I think she has an uncanny ability to evoke moods, environments, people through her voicings, which sometimes sound very similar to language but contains no words. This is a short piece. If it makes you uncomfortable or confuses you, I think that's all the more reason to keep listening to hear Meredith Monk discuss her music. That recording is from Meredith Monk's album, Our Lady of Late. The whining that you heard in the background was her finger going over the surface of a rim of glass partially filled with water. If you've never heard Meredith Monk's music before, I don't know what that recording did for you. For me, it kind of penetrates places that words don't often penetrate. It reaches very private places, and I'm wondering if it comes from very private places in you.
Well, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Where do you see the place of your music? I mean, if I'm sitting at home, for instance, I would put on an album of yours at a very different time than I would put on a Duke Ellington album,
right.
You know.
I don't think it's music that you can wash the dishes by very much. I think it's really demanding in a certain way for its full attention, and somehow that I've been pretty conscious about. Even more so, Our Lady of Late is, in a way, Our Lady of Late, I have played it in the country, which is really, you know, really out in the country, and it's really is a nice record to put on and then just walk around the house or something like that, and you don't have to sit and listen to it, you know, with full attention in the country, it seems. But something like Key, which was the first record, that I really made to be heard like a theater piece, that you would lie down and you would turn out your lights or whatever and you would really listen to this thing. It's got a beginning and an end, you know, it's really like one act, and you turn over the record and it continues to the end, and I was really trying to almost evoke, I call it an album of invisible theater. I was trying to evoke images and landscapes within that voice. You know, I call it the traveling voice, and then there's these monologues that other people do. It's really theatrical, and I was really trying for that I wanted people to really sit down and listen to it.
Let's talk about your images for a while, because I think that they have some of the same qualities as your music does, that they... they're very evocative and also very nonspecific.
Mm-hmm.
In Quarry, for instance, do you want to kind of capsulize for us what happens in Quarry?
Oh, gee, it's a very complex piece. But basically, where it came from was it was a certain impulse to do a piece that commemorated in a sense. The piece was about World War II, and it was World War II in a way seen through the unconscious. It was the archetypical World War II, or the collective unconscious version of World War II. From in my generation, I was just a tiny little baby in World War II, but it was an event that happened in the world at a certain point that affected all of us that came after it. Of course, the people that lived through it, the people that lived before it, and, you know, even people that were born after it. It's still part of all of our lives. Somehow after that phenomenon that happened in the world was not the same, and it was somehow some kind of way of coming to terms with it. I happened to be of Jewish birth, and that was also something that I was trying to deal with a lot, you know, my identity in terms of that, and, you know, what that was about, you know, how could evil of that, you know, of that size exist? It was also all of us trying to deal with evil, in a way. And it was very exciting for our whole company, The House, very exciting, because everybody's different ages. There are some people there's one man who's 60 in my company to, you know, 15. So everybody was dealing with their lives and what that meant to them. And, you know, even though I thought of the piece for 2 or 3 years before we started working on it, and not a lot of, you know, and I really made the music and the material for it, I think everybody felt very close to it and deep, you know, with doing it. And what it is I play a child, and the child, in a sense, becomes a sick child, and you don't know exactly what she's sick with. You don't know if she has a fever or whether it's like some kind of disease. You just don't know what it is, but it's a sick child as kind of the vessel or the receptacle of the evil of the world, in a way. She's like the microcosm. Her sickness is the microcosm of what happens in the world, which is like, you know, a sick world. And it just starts to build slowly. You don't exactly know. You just see the child, and you see her family, or different. It can either be parts of her family, or it can be people in different countries at the same time, living in a very innocent way, living in their innocence. And then little by little, this evil thing starts creeping around the outside. Like, you start seeing someone coming and taking photographs of this Hebrew couple, and they start running, and you don't exactly know what it is. It's all it is little pieces of information, but you haven't been able to put it together for a while. And then little by little, you get this kind of evil force coming in around the edges, and then suddenly all the people who are her grandfather and her grandmother and the mother start turning into these dictators, these very grotesque dictators, and then finally there's the real dictator. those dictators I think of almost as comic relief. And then you have the real dictator, and he does this whole kind of verbal and also movement harangue, which is very much like Hitler in a way, again, archetypical of Hitler, but Ping Chong does it in his own way. I mean, it's just, again, like it's his own personal dictator, but you get all those kind of reverberations of the Nuremberg rallies and what that is, again, as a phenomenon of how easy it is to create something like that. And then we do this big rally with about 45 people in it with a lot of things going on at the same time and very guttural sounds and movement, like exercise movement, very vigorous movement. And again, it just, you know, it's so easy to create that. It's very exciting. Everyone in the audience is just excited but also terrified. But not such a difficult thing to create. So somehow, for our whole way of work, when we were working on Quarry, you know, the realization that I could have taken 15 people, done three vocal a certain kind of vocal sound and movement, and created in a way the same phenomenon that the Germans did create, and to see how easy it is to create that, and how exciting it is, how the roots of that go so deep in the human being, like the hate and the fear and everything, but how easy it is to stir that up. And then after that, suddenly all the people that have been doing the rally and that are like the dictators, you know, all the people that are hailing the dictator, all of a sudden, before you even know it in front of your eyes, they've turned into the victims being taken away. They have suitcases and, you know, all of a sudden it changes. You don't even see the change. The people who were the, you know, the victorious become the victims. And then, like, the piece just keeps reeling off very fast, and the child is left alone after all this has happened. And, you know, and you get, like, this kind of a summary of the mother up in the recording booth and the dictator, and the child is alone. And then she's kind of has this realization that this exists, and then she just starts singing a requiem, which is like the last thing, and all the whole cast comes in. They're really more as if they're themselves, and they sing this requiem, which is just a melodic, very melodic, you know, kind of lament. And that's how the piece ends.
You managed to really capture the essence of what it is we fear about a dictator, what it is we fear about war, fear about night, or fear about sickness.
Right.
I mean, no one in my recollection really had a character sketched out. You know, you didn't have any expectations about how they'd react in any given situation, what kind of, you know, words they might respond to if you asked them for something, or, you know,
right,
entered into a dialogue with
right.
them. But the emotions were absolutely clear.
Right.
I want to mention,
I mean, I'm very much, you know, I'm not a documentary kind of artist, and I'm not really a political artist on a very specific basis. And it was hard to work with that material in a way, because of course it brings you right into politics on a certain level, it does. But I still wanted to make it into a very poetic form and an abstract form in a way.
I should mention here, I didn't mention it in the introduction, that Meredith Monk received an Obie Award for Quarry. When I entered the theater at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, we were talking about this a little bit before, the scene was already set. I mean, the stage setting was out there, and so were the opening characters.
One character, the maid.
The child wasn't there?
No.
Okay, the maid was there, and she was reading Time magazine or something, yeah, and rocking back
yeah.
and forth in the chair. And I figured, well, that's the beginning of the piece. And it lasted, maybe 10 minutes, and I was starting to get really uncomfortable. I mean, I was prepared to be receptive. You know, you always prepare
yeah.
yourself when you're going to the theater, but I said to myself, oh, enough.
Right.
I've gotten the point. You know,
right.
I started to feel like, oh, they're trying to prepare me for an experience, and, you know, they're trying to make me relax, but I was just getting more and more uncomfortable.
Ochi.
Yeah, yeah. Tell us what happened there.
Well, that whole section of the maid just sweeping around and the radio playing, that was just what I would call a preset, which is just something that exists as the audience is walking in. That is, in a way, I like the idea of a piece already, in a sense, something being set up as an audience, the world that's going to be created, set up when the audience comes in. I don't enjoy like coming into a dark theater and just having nothing that has to do with what's going to go on, and then the curtains go down and then you're into it. I like walking into something. That's what, you know, excites me, to walk in and see, you know, the magic of that world already created. Now in this situation, all that was meant to, wasn't really even part of the piece. It was the preset. She was, you know, just existing in that space as the audience came in. But in the Brooklyn Academy, they insisted on waiting until like every last person got in before the lights went down, which is not what I would do in my own, with my own choice. My own choice is the audience is walking in, this is going on at the same time. It's not something that you have to really pay attention to. You could still be talking in your seat or something like that, you know, and be reading the program or whatever. It just is kind of there. And then, you know, the lights go down, and then when I say I don't feel well, when the child says I don't feel well, that's the beginning of the piece.
It's interesting that if there had not been a character sitting in one of those chairs, I certainly wouldn't have thought that the piece had started.
Right, right.
So, okay, so you usually...
But actually, you see, the thing is, in that preset, what happened was that she didn't come in until about the last 5 minutes, Coco. And she wasn't there the whole time, but again, because the time thing got so pulled out, you know, it was just so ridiculous, it just was too long that she had to deal, you know, she had to deal with that. It was awfully hard for her, too, some nights. You know, it didn't happen every night, just some nights, they just insisted on waiting till one person came in, and she had to deal with that, which was really hard for her as a performer. It was real hard for her.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have to deal with a lot of stillness in your performances. Mm-hmm. I imagine
me,
both
as a child, yeah, I do.
As the child in choir, and I imagine in some of your vocal performances, mm-hmm, too, mm-hmm, when you're doing a solo.
Well, something like Our Lady of Late, I have the movement of the glass, and I tend to rock when I'm singing, too. It's almost like I feel like I'm a little bit like a sibyl or something when I'm singing a lot. And in Our Lady of Late, I'll tend to rock around the chair as I'm going around with my finger on the glass. In Songs from the Hill, one of the things I like about Songs from the Hill is that it's the first time that I don't have to deal with my hands on a piano, my hands on a glass. I'm just standing there, you know, like a dunkhead, like singing, you know. Now, then I can move my whole body if I want to. Also, I've done another piece that's called Plateau, which is using these Songs from the Hill that I'll be singing on Friday, but it's a dance piece. So in that piece, I dance full out and sing these things at the same time. Mm. So that's a whole nother level there. But I see myself, I like both. They're good for different reasons. Songs from the Hill, the dancing, of course, my body is able to move, and that's very exciting. And I mean, in Plateau, and I've got to sing. That's a real endurance thing. Like sometimes I'll be dancing full out and then I'll have to sing the next song and I've got to deal with my breath and the control and everything. But the thing that's nice about Songs from the Hill is that, of just standing there and singing, is that I can be like pinpointed in my attention and pinpointed in my concentration. And you really can hear the thing, that you hear the songs much better that way than when you also have to deal with watching me move. Of course, I sing them better when I'm just standing too, you know. You know, they're much more, they're deeper, like sung, they're sung deeper, you know, because I don't have to worry about that I'm out of breath. And
do you have any ritual or, you know, warm-up that
yeah,
you do,
I do
before
a whole,
a concert?
Sure, a whole long vocal warm-up, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Any preparation that you have to do, you know, emotionally to prepare yourself for that experience?
I'm not a Stanislavski kind of method, uh-huh, you know, performer at all, you know, psychological, psych up and stuff like that. No, it's more... a lot of breathing, a vocal warm-up, and actually what I'll usually do, which I probably will do tomorrow, a good physical warm-up before I sing.
Is there any improvisation in your performance? Because it sounds like it could be improvised, but on the other hand, you really sense an incredible amount of precision in it, which makes you think that improvisation plays a very small role.
Well, again, it's the difference between me singing alone and the theater pieces and when I'm singing with other people. When I'm singing alone, I have, there's some, now again, depending on which are the tunes, the ones that are the ones that have the most melodic kind of feeling to them, of course, they're notated. The ones where they're more a textural thing, I'll always sing the same thing every night, but on a note-to-note, if you heard one night to another, I might play with it a little bit more one night than another. So I have that kind of freedom because I'm, you know, working alone. In the theater pieces, they're very, very precise. They're almost like films. I mean, I feel like that. I'm really interested in structure. I'm not that interested in improvisation. And I really, you know, the way I make a theater piece like Quarry is almost like a filmmaker. You know, I have this image and then that sound, and it's structured really carefully. So there's not a lot of improvisation at all. I mean, within the roles that people have, I mean, they can, again, play a little bit. I would never want to, I'd never say one, two, three, you know, you've got to, I mean, it has to have some life in it, but, you know, the structural thing is very set, and then, you know, there's always a little room for each person to play. I mean, that's what makes an alive performance, you know, one way or the other. The timing, slight shifts in timing, and, you know, with the piece that you'll see, Tablet, which is with the four women, that, of course, is, as soon as you get into more than one voice, you've got to really deal with it being quite set.
Mm-hmm. The performance that Meredith Monk is referring to is tomorrow evening at the University Museum, where her concert's being sponsored by the Institute of Contemporary Art at 8 o'clock. Let's talk about audience a little bit. I find, you know, when I go to see a concert or a theater piece, I try to prepare myself for anything because you never know if you're going to really love it or if you're really going to be bored, you know. What kind of audience are you, you know, when you go to see a piece? Will you walk out on a piece if you're not enjoying
it? I've never walked out on a piece. That I've never done. But I've only done that once, and I had very dire consequences from that because if people, well, especially in New York, if they know I'm in the they know I'm in the audience, and I've got to take that consequence that I've walked out on someone's piece. And I only did that once, and that was when I was with Ping, who insisted on leaving. He couldn't stand it any longer, and he wanted his turkey dinner or something like that, and I left. I shouldn't have, but I did leave. I'll usually sit through to the bloody end, but I'm a hard audience. I'm a real hard audience to please because I'm real picky, and you know, I'm just looking, you know, with a very, in a way, a craftsman, you know, I'm looking with a craftsman's eye, you know, at how something's put together, you know, or, you know, like, and I'm a better movie audience. I'm a sucker for films.
When you find yourself getting bored at a theater piece, are you able to, like, still maintain a critical eye on it, or do you find that your mind wanders and you start doing internal monologues
and stuff? My mind wanders and I get very angry and I shift in my seat and sputter and
I'll tell you,
whisper.
You know,
I
think, but I'm not sure that for people who are ever, you know, who ever fear boredom when they're going to see a performance event, that that maybe this isn't true, but maybe they worry more about avant-garde pieces because given the experimental nature and the experimental nature of time in a lot of pieces.
Right.
And the,
well, there's a big
also
difference
the
between
the
boredom and time.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there's a big difference between boredom. See, boredom was a kind of an aesthetic, you know, for a certain period of, you know, I always think of ennui as like the 20s in Paris. I feel like that was an aesthetic. That was a whole thing that people were dealing with. Gertrude Stein, like, I always think of boredom as part of that aesthetic. You know, in a way. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
As
know
part
what you
of like an intentional aesthetic, Satie, you know, furniture, music, like that kind of thing. And see, I think, you know, there is a difference between boredom and time. I mean, if something is very is evocative, if it has like evocation, and there's like an extended time length, I mean, I think that's very interesting. I think dislocating time is a very interesting thing to work with in the theater work, not so much in the music. I can't really work with it that much in the music because the music has a certain kind of impulse and it has a certain kind of beat to it, not necessarily, you know, a metric beat, but it's got a real thrust. And I don't really play with time that much with the music. I mean, time duration that much. But in the theater pieces, I'm very interested in like that kind of dislocation that you can get from either extending time or compressing it, you know, or and the combination of the two. And that I'll never mind. I'll never mind a theater piece. As a matter of fact, I mean, I'm thinking of two people's work now. One is Ken Jacobs, who's a person that whose work I like very much. Another person is Peter Schumann, who is in the Bread and Puppet Theater. And to some people, Peter Schumann's work is the slowest thing imaginable. I mean, it takes so long to get from one effect to another because he's working with 15-foot puppets and, you know, all these masks and this and that. And he's always been very leisurely, and he's never been that interested in a very slick kind of time sense. So it's very kind of, you know, it's really very clumsy in a way, the way that he'll get from one image to another. But I appreciate that because somehow that's the purity of that work. And all the images are always worth waiting for.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way I also feel about Ken Jacobs. It's a very informal kind of style. It's not, he works with film, a lot of film and optical kind of images. Beautiful pieces, you know, always with optics. Very magical. His thing is called Apparition Theater and very magic. And boy, it takes like 15 minutes for them to change from one, you know, image set up and set up for the next one. But somehow the spirit of the piece is so generous or something, and the images are so worth the waiting for that I don't mind that much, you know. And there are a number of pieces that are like that, but if the images are puny and it's just like you know, amateurishness and lack of kind of skill, then I really get angry. And also, again, it has to do with consciousness. If the person, you can tell whether people are idiots or whether they know what they're doing, you
mm-hmm.
know. And if they're idiots, I won't wait, you know. If they know what they're doing, I'll wait.
I think you've said some very interesting things. You know, one of the reasons one of the reasons why I asked you about boredom is because in the role you played as the young sick child in Quarry, I got the feeling not of being bored, just to explain this, but that you as the child were in a situation where you were bored, frustrated, and impotent. And I don't know if I'm reading that correct at all, but just some of the body language really suggested like deep boredom to me. Like there's a period where your leg kicks and kicks, and I don't know. It was very strong to me. I think
it was more restlessness or feverishness. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what I was thinking. I was never bored as a child, believe me. I was listening to everything. I was directing the piece, you know, from that bed, for one thing, and listening to what was going on and taking mental notes in my head as to telling Lanny to do that section faster and stuff like that.
No, I'm certainly not saying that you were bored, but the role you were
playing. No, I think it was more like that kind of restlessness that, you know, I don't know, do you remember when you were sick and you were little and you
would
like kind of, you know, you just fling your, you know, flail about, you know, and then you'd be able to go back to sleep again, then you'd flail about. I think it was more that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And the real, when I was really flailing in that bed, that was during the rally, though. And that was much more as if I was, you know, sometimes when it was really good, I felt as if that rally was like the ocean or something, and that it would just, the impulse from that, the energy from that would just fling me out of that bed, you know, and that was the idea, that somehow it had this real destructive kind of feeling to it, that the rally just, the child was almost killed by the rally, you know, and was almost dead by the time it was over. So that was that kind of feeling to it.
Meredith, let's talk a little bit about
And she is passive. I mean, that, and of course, for me as a performer, that's hard, because, I mean, you know, that's hard to deal with as a performer. What do you do with that? But that's the idea of that was that she was, in a sense, the receptacle of all that. She was the vessel. You know, and that was right. It was correct that she was. I mean, I think for the piece, again, I always have to put everything, you know, on the table as to what the piece is, what the piece demands. That's what I have to do, and that was the right thing for that child.
Let's talk a little bit about your upcoming concert tomorrow night at 8 at the University Museum. You've told us a little bit about what you have planned. Maybe you can just tell us what you'd like us to know. I mean, frankly, what I'd like you to do is, if someone is coming to see your concert who is really pretty unfamiliar with your music, what would you like to have them know that you might not have already said about?
Well, I think Songs from the Hill, Songs from the Hill is a piece that I wrote in New Mexico, sitting outside in a hill. Every day I would go and write one song. And it was a very strange thing, because I felt very shy about singing in nature, and I would sing real quietly and everything for a lot of days. You know, I was shy about it. It was singing in nature in that quiet. But what I found that would happen is that I would sit for many hours sometimes. Some days I would only sit for a little while, and then it was a kind of like a meditation, and then something would come out of me, or I would sit for 5 hours in the sun and something would come out of me. And I found that I was doing bird songs and insect songs and frog songs, and, you know, it was just amazing. Now, not consciously, but it was almost as if I was a mirror of that environment. And I think, like, when you hear Songs from the Hill, like, you really do get the sense of someone being outside. You know, it has a real nature feeling, much more than my other music, where I think of it more as people. This, I think of it more as, like, forces of nature or something like that. And I think it's just to, you know, somehow listen to this voice going through all its transformations. You know, all the different changes and varieties and everything that the voice does.
Mm-hmm.
And just to try not to intellectualize, I think that's the thing, not to try to figure it out, to just, you know, let it be for that period of time and then go home and think about it. I think that's the best way of listening to it.
Uh-huh. And
not being afraid of the emotions, because it's very naked. It's like seeing, in a way, Songs from the Hill is the most naked piece. I don't have a piano to rely on. I don't have anything. I've just got me standing there and singing these things. And it's very primal, you know, in a way. And sometimes I think that's hard for people to take. So they think, like, I must be, it doesn't hurt me to do it. I feel wonderful. I mean, it's exquisite for me. But, you know, it is like seeing a naked woman, you know, in a way. Not like with no clothes, but I mean a naked soul, like, laid out there, you know.
Okay. We're going to be hearing an excerpt of Tablet, the other piece you'll be performing tomorrow night. Do you want to say a few words about that?
Tablet is exciting to me because it's the first time I've worked with three other real virtuoso singers. And it's very exciting to, you know, it's with three other women. I know much more, of course, about a woman's range and stuff like that than I do about a man's. And it has a kind of feeling of these, again, almost like these four sibyls or something in a cave. Or I always get a very ancient kind of feeling from Tablet. Tablet, we mean tablet meaning like a hieroglyphic, you know, like a stone tablet or something like that. And it's a piece that it's very episodic. It's almost like, you know, now they're in like this little room and now they're in a cave. And, you know, and it's kind of like a journey. And that's it.
Okay. I want to tell you how happy I am that you were able to come to WUHY
Thank
this
you.
Afternoon.
I'm really happy to be here.